close call. The woman was like a rabid dog. His hands were shaking now. He needed a drink.
It will be over when Craik wakes up?
Yes, when he wakes up.
We hope he will wake up very soon.
And so they walked together through no man's land, stopping here and there to graze or picking leaves and flowers as they went, the women and children hand in hand, several of them singing in their crystal voices, their voices like fronds unrolling. Then they wound through the streets of the Pleblands like a skewed parade or a fringe religious procession. During the afternoon storms they took shelter, easy to do, as doors and windows had ceased to have meaning. Then, in the freshened air, they continued their stroll. Some of the buildings along the way were still smoldering. There were many questions and much explaining to do. What is that smoke? It is a thing of Craik's. Why is that child lying down with no eyes? It was the will of Craik, and so forth. Snowman made it up as he went along. He knew what an improbable shepherd he was. To reassure them, he tried his best to appear dignified and reliable, wise and kindly. A lifetime of deviousness came to his aid. Finally, they reached the edge of the park. Snowman had to shoot only two more disintegrating people. He was doing them a favor, so he didn't feel too bad about it. He felt worse about other things. Late in the evening, they came at last to the shore. The leaves of the trees were rustling, the water was gently waving, the setting sun was reflected on it, pink and red. The sands were white, the offshore towers overflowing with birds.
"It is so beautiful here. Oh, look, are those feathers? What is this place called?"
"It is called home," said Snowman. 14. Idle. Snowman rifles the storeroom, packs what he can carry. The rest of the food, dried and in tins, flashlight and batteries, maps and matches and candles, ammunition packs, duct tape, two bottles of water, painkiller pills, antibiotic gel, a couple of sunproof shirts, and one of those little knives with the scissors. And the spray gun, of course. He picks up his stick and heads out through the airlock doorway, avoiding Craik's gaze, Craik's grin, and Oryx in her silk butterfly shroud.
"Oh, Jimmy, that's not me."
Bird songs beginning. The pre-dawn light is a feathery gray, the air misty. Dew pearls the spider webs. If he were a child, it would seem fresh and new, this ancient magical effect. As it is, he knows it's an illusion. Once the sun's up, all will vanish. Halfway across the grounds, he stops, takes one last backward look at paradise, swelling up out of the foliage like a lost balloon. He has a map of the compound. He's already studied it, charted his route. He cuts across a main artery to the golf course and crosses it without incident. His pack and the gun are beginning to weigh on him, so he stops for a drink. The sun's up now. The vultures are rising on their updrafts. They've spotted him. They'll note his limp. They'll be watching. He makes his way through a residential section, then across a school ground. He has to shoot one pigoon before he reaches the peripheral wall. It was just having a good stare, but he was certain it was a scout. It would have told the others. At the side gate, he pauses. There's a watchtower here, and access to the rampart. He'd like to climb up, have a look around, check out that smoke he saw. But the door to the gatehouse is locked, so he goes on out. Nothing in the moat. He crosses no man's land, a nervous passage. He keeps seeing furry movement at the sides of his eyes, and worries that the clumps of weeds are changing shape. At last he's in the Pleblands. He wends his way through the narrow streets, alert for ambushes, but nothing hunts him. Only the vultures circle above, waiting for him to be meat. An hour before noon he climbs a tree, conceals himself in the shade of the leaves. There he eats a tin of Soyo Boy wieners and finishes the first bottle of water. Once he stops walking, his foot asserts itself. There's a regular throbbing. It feels hot and tight, as if it's crammed into a tiny shoe. He rubs some antibiotic gel into the cut, but without much faith. The microbes infecting him have doubtless already mounted their resistance and are simmering away in there, turning his flesh to porridge. He scans the horizon from his arboreal vantage point, but he can't see anything that looks like smoke. Arboreal, a fine word. Our arboreal ancestors, Craig used to say, used to shit on their enemies from above while perched in trees. All planes and rockets and bombs are simply elaborations on that primate instinct. What if I die up here, in this tree, he thinks? Will it serve me right? Why? Who will ever find me? And so what if they do? Oh, look, another dead man. Big fucking deal. Common as dirt. Yeah, but this one's in a tree. So who cares? I'm not just any dead man, he says out loud. Of course not. Each one of us is unique, and every single dead person is dead in his or her very own special way. Now, who wants to share about being dead, in our own special words? Jimmy, you seem eager to talk, so why don't you begin? Oh, torture. Is this purgatory? And if it is, why is it so much like the first grade? After a couple of hours of fitful rest, he moves on, holding up from the afternoon storm in the remains of a plebland condo. Nobody in it, dead or alive. Then he continues on, limpity-limp, picking up speed now, heading south and then east, towards the shore. It's a relief when he hits the snowman fish path. Instead of turning left towards his tree, he hobbles along towards the village. He's tired, he wants to sleep, but he'll have to reassure the Krakers, demonstrate his safe return, explain why he's been away so long, deliver his message from Craik. He'll need to invent some lies about that. What did Craik look like? I couldn't see him. He was in a bush. A burning bush. Why not? Best to be nonspecific about the facial features. But he gave some orders. I get 2 fish a week. No, make it 3. And roots and berries. Maybe he should add seaweed to that. They'll know which kinds are good. And crabs, too. Not the land crabs. The other kinds. He'll order them up steamed, 12 at a time. Surely that's not too much to ask. After he's seen the Krakers, he'll stow away his new food and eat some of it, and then have a doze in his familiar tree. After that, he'll be refreshed, and his brain will be working better, and he'll be able to think about what to do next. What to do next about what? That's too difficult. But suppose there are other people around. People like himself, smoke-making people. He'll wish to be in some kind of shape to greet them. He'll wash up. This one time he can risk the bathing pool, then put on one of the clean, sunproof shirts he's brought, maybe hack off some of his beard with the little scissors on the knife. Damn, he forgot to bring a pocket mirror. Brain fart. As he approaches the village, he hears an unusual sound, an odd crooning, high voices and deep ones, men's and women's both, harmonious, two-noted. It isn't singing, it's more like chanting. Then a clang, a series of pings, a boom. What are they doing? Whatever it is, they've never done anything like it before. Here's the line of demarcation, the stinky but invisible chemical wall of piss renewed by the men each day. He steps across it, moves cautiously forward, peers from behind a shrub. There they are. He does a quick head count. Most of the young, all of the adults minus 5. Must be a fivesome off in the woods, mating. They're sitting in a semicircle around a grotesque-looking figure, a scarecrow-like effigy. All their attention is focused on it. They don't at first see him as he steps out from behind the shrub and limps forward. "Oh," croon the women. "Moan," the men in tone. Is that amen? Surely not. Not after Craig's precautions, his insistence on keeping these people pure, free of all contamination of that kind. And they certainly didn't get that word from Snowman. It can't have happened. Clank. Ping, 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 ping. Boom. Ah-moon. Now he can see the percussion group. The instruments are a hubcap and a metal rod. Those create the clanks, and a series of empty bottles dangling from a tree branch and played with a serving spoon. The boom is from an oil drum, hit with what looks like a kitchen mallet. Where did they get these things?
off the beach, no doubt. He feels as if he's watching his daycare rhythm band of long ago, but with huge, green-eyed children. What's the thing? The statue or a scarecrow or whatever it is. It has a head and a ragged cloth body. It has a face of sorts, one pebble eye, one black one, a jar lid, it looks like. It has an old string mop stuck onto the chin. Now they've seen him. They scramble to their feet, hurry to greet him, surround him. All are smiling happily. The children jump up and down, laughing. Some of the women clap their hands with excitement. This is more energy than they usually display about anything. "Snowman! Snowman!" They touch him gently with their fingertips. "You are back with us. We knew we could call you, and you would hear us and come back." Not Ah-Man, then. Snowman. "We made a picture of you to help us send out our voices to you." "Watch out for art," Craig used to say. "As soon as they start doing art, we're in trouble." Symbolic thinking of any kind would signal downfall, in Craig's view. Next, they'd be inventing idols and funerals and grave goods and the afterlife and sin and Linear B and kings and then slavery and war. Snowman longs to question them. Who first had the idea of making a reasonable facsimile of him, of Snowman, out of a jar lid and a mop? But that will have to wait. "Look, Snowman has flowers on him." This from the children, who've noticed his new floral sarong. "Can we have flowers on us, too? Was it difficult, your journey into the sky? Flowers, too! Flowers, too! What message does Craig send us?"
"Why do you think I've been into the sky?" Snowman asks, as neutrally as possible. He's clicking through the legend files in his head. When did he ever mention the sky? Did he relate some fable about where Craig had come from? Yes. Now he remembers. He'd given Craig the attributes of thunder and lightning. Naturally, they assume Craig must have gone back up to Cloudland.
"We know Craig lives in the sky, and we saw the whirling wind. It went the way you went. Craig sent it for you, to help you rise from the ground. Now you have been to the sky. You are almost like Craig."
Best not to contradict them, but he can't let them continue in a belief that he can fly. Sooner or later they might expect him to demonstrate. "The whirling wind was so Craig could come down out of the sky," he says. "He made the wind to blow him down from above. He decided not to stay up there, because the sun was too hot. So that isn't where I saw him."
"Where is he?"
"He's in the bubble," Snowman says, truthfully enough. "The place we came from. He's in paradise."
"Let us go there and see him," says one of the older children. "We know how to get there. We remember."
"You can't see him," Snowman says, a little too sharply. "You wouldn't recognize him. He's turned himself into a plant." Now where did that come from? He's very tired. He's losing it. "Why would Craig become food?" asks Abraham Lincoln. "It's not a plant you can eat," says Snowman. "It's more like a tree." Some puzzled looks.
"He talks to you. How does he talk if he is a tree?"
This is going to be hard to explain. He's made a narrative mistake. He has the sensation that he's lost his balance at the top of a flight of stairs. He flails for a grip. "It's a tree with a mouth," he says.
"Trees don't have mouths," says one of the children.
"But look," says a woman. "Madame Curie? Sacagawea?"
"Snowman has hurt his foot."
The women can always sense his discomfort. They try to ease it by changing the subject.
"We must help him."
"Let us get him a fish. Would you like a fish now, Snowman? We will ask Oryx to give you a fish, to die for you."
That would be good," he says with relief.
"Oryx wants you to be well." Soon he's lying on the ground, and they're purring over him. The pain lessens, but although they try very hard, the swelling will not go all the way down.
"It must have been a deep hurt. It will need more. We will try again later."
They bring the fish, cooked now and wrapped in leaves, and watch joyfully while he eats it. He's not that hungry, it's the fever, but he tries hard because he doesn't want to frighten them. Already the children are destroying the image they made of him, reducing it to its component parts, which they plan to return to the beach. This is a teaching of Oryx, the women tell him. After a thing has been used, it must be given back to its place of origin. The picture of snowman has done its work. Now that the real snowman is among them once more, there is no reason for the other, the less satisfactory one. Snowman finds it odd to see his erstwhile beard, his erstwhile head, traveling away piecemeal in the hands of the children. It's as if he himself has been torn apart and scattered.
Sermon. Some others like you came here, says Abraham Lincoln, after Snowman has done his best with the fish. He's lying back against a tree trunk. His foot is gently tingling now, as if it's asleep. He feels drowsy. Snowman jolts awake. Others like me. With those other skins like you, says Napoleon, and one of them had feathers on his face like you. Another one had feathers, too, but not long feathers. We thought they were sent by Craik, like you. One was a female. She must have been sent by Oryx. She smelled blue. We couldn't see the blue because of her other skin. But she smelled very blue. The men began to sing to her. We offered her flowers and signaled to her with our penises, but she did not respond with joy. The men with the extra skins didn't look happy. They looked angry. We went towards them to greet them, but they ran away.
Snowman can imagine. The sight of these preternaturally calm, well-muscled men advancing en masse, singing their unusual music, green eyes glowing, blue penises waving in unison, both hands outstretched like extras in a zombie film, would have to have been alarming. Snowman's heart is going very fast now, with excitement or fear or a blend.
Were they carrying anything?
One of them had a noisy stick, like yours. Snowman's spray gun is out of sight. They must remember the gun from before, from when they walked out of paradise. But they didn't make any noise with it. The children of Craik are very nonchalant about all this. They don't realize the implications. It's as if they're discussing rabbits.
When did they come here?
Oh, the day before, maybe? Useless to try to pin them down about any past event. They don't count the days.
Where did they go?
They went there, along the beach. Why did they run away from us, O Snowman?
Perhaps they heard Craik, says Sacagawea. Perhaps he was calling to them. They had shiny things on their arms like you, things for listening to Craik.
I'll ask them, says Snowman. I'll go and talk with them. I'll do it tomorrow. Now I will go to sleep. He heaves himself upright, winces with pain. He still can't put much weight on that foot. We will come too, say several of the men. No, says Snowman. I don't think that would be a very good idea.
But you are not well enough yet, says the Empress Josephine. You need more purring.
She looks worried. A small frown has appeared between her eyes. Unusual to see such an expression on one of their perfect, wrinkle-free faces. Snowman submits, and a new purring team, three men this time, one woman, they must think he needs strong medicine, hovers over his leg. He tries to sense a responding vibration inside himself, wondering, not for the first time, whether this method is tailored to work only on them. Those who aren't purring watch the operation closely. Some converse in low voices, and after half an hour or so, a fresh team takes over. He can't relax into the sound as he knows he should, because he's rehearsing the future. He can't help it. His mind is racing. Behind his half-closed eyes, possibilities flash and collide. Maybe all will be well. Maybe this trio of strangers is good-hearted, sane, well-intentioned. Maybe he'll succeed in presenting the Krakers to them in the proper light. On the other hand, these new arrivals could easily see the children of Craik as freakish, or savage, or non-human and a threat. Images from old history flip through his head, sidebars from Blood and Roses, Genghis Khan's skull pile, the heaps of shoes and eyeglasses from Dachau, the burning corpse-filled churches in Rwanda, the sack of Jerusalem by the Crusaders. The Arawak Indians, welcoming Christopher Columbus with garlands and gifts of fruit, smiling with delight, soon to be massacred,
or tied up beneath the beds upon which their women were being raped. But why imagine the worst? Maybe these people have been frightened off. Maybe they'll have moved elsewhere. Maybe they're ill and dying. Or maybe not. Before he reconnoiters, before he sets out on what he now sees is a mission, he should make a speech of some kind to the Krakers, a sort of sermon. Lay down a few commandments, Krake's parting words to them. Except that they don't need commandments. No thou shalt nots would be any good to them, or even comprehensible, because it's all built in. No point in telling them not to lie, steal, commit adultery, or covet. They wouldn't grasp the concepts. He should say something to them, though. Leave them with a few words to remember. Better some practical advice. He should say he might not be coming back. He should say that the others, the ones with extra skins and feathers, are not from Krake. He should say their noisy stick should be taken away from them and thrown into the sea. He should say that if these people should become violent, oh, snowman, please, what is violent? Or if they attempt to rape, what is rape? The women, or molest, what? The children, or if they try to force others to work for them. Hopeless. Hopeless. What is work? Work is when you build things. What is build? Or grow things. What is grow? Either because people would hit and kill you if you didn't, or else because they would give you money if you did. What is money? No. He can't say any of that. Krake is watching over you, he'll say. Oryx loves you. Then his eyes close, and he feels himself being lifted gently, carried, lifted again, carried again, held. 15. Footprint. Snowman wakes before dawn. He lies unmoving, listening to the tide coming in, wish-wash, wish-wash, the rhythm of heartbeat. He would so like to believe he is still asleep. On the eastern horizon there's a grayish haze, lit now with a rosy, deadly glow. Strange how that color still seems tender. He gazes at it with rapture. There is no other word for it. Rapture. The heart seized, carried away, as if by some large bird of prey. After everything that's happened, how can the world still be so beautiful? Because it is. From the offshore towers come the avian shrieks and cries that sound like nothing human. He takes a few deep breaths, scans the ground below for wildlife, makes his way down from the tree, setting his good foot on the ground first. He checks the inside of his hat, flicks out an ant. Can a single ant be said to be alive, in any meaningful sense of the word, or does it only have relevance in terms of its anthill? An old conundrum of Krake's. He hobbles across the beach to the water's edge, washes his foot, feels the sting of salt. There must have been a boil. The thing must have ruptured overnight. The wound feels huge now. The flies buzz around him, waiting for a chance to settle. Then he limps back up to the tree line, takes off his flowered bedsheet, hangs it on a branch. He doesn't want to be impeded. He'll wear nothing but his baseball cap, to keep the glare out of his eyes. He'll dispense with the sunglasses. It's early enough, so they won't be needed. He needs to catch every nuance of movement. He pees on the grasshoppers, watches with nostalgia as they whir away. Already this routine of his is entering the past, like a lover seen from a train window, waving goodbye, pulled inexorably back, in space, in time, so quickly. He goes to his cache, opens it, drinks some water. His foot hurts like shit. It's red around the wound again, his ankle swollen. Whatever's in there has overcome the cocktail from paradise and the treatment of the Krakers as well. He rubs on some of the antibiotic gel, useless as mud. Luckily, he's got aspirins. Those will dull the pain. He swallows four, chews up half a jolt bar for the energy. Then he takes out his spray gun, checks the cell pack of virtual bullets. He's not ready for this. He's not well. He's frightened. He could choose to stay put, await developments. Oh, honey, you're my only hope. He follows the beach northward, using his stick for balance,
keeping to the shadow of the trees as much as possible. The sky's brightening. He needs to hurry. He can see the smoke now, rising in a thin column. It will take him an hour or more to get there. They don't know about him, those people. They know about the Krakers, but not about him. They won't be expecting him. That's his best chance. From tree to tree he limps, elusive, white, a rumor, in search of his own kind. Here's a human footprint in the sand. Then another one. They aren't sharp-edged because the sand here is dry, but there's no mistaking them. And now here's a whole trail of them, leading down to the sea, several different sizes. Where the sand turns damp, he can see them better. What were these people doing? Swimming? Fishing? Washing themselves? They were wearing shoes, or sandals. Here's where they took them off. Here's where they put them on again. He stamps his own good foot into the wet sand beside the biggest footprint, a signature of a kind. As soon as he lifts his foot away, the imprint fills with water. He can smell the smoke. He can hear the voices now. Sneaking, he goes, as if walking through an empty house in which there might yet be people. What if they should see him? A hairy, naked maniac, wearing nothing but a baseball cap and carrying a spray gun. What would they do? Scream and run? Attack? Open their arms to him with joy and brotherly love? He peers out through the screen of leaves. There are only three of them, sitting around their fire. They've got a spray gun of their own, a Corpsichore Daily Special, but it's lying on the ground. They're thin, battered-looking. Two men, one brown, one white, a tea-colored woman, the men in tropical khakis, standard issue but filthy, the woman in the remains of a uniform of some kind. Nurse? Guard? Must have been pretty once, before she lost all that weight. Now she's stringy, her hair parched, broom straw. All three of them look wasted. They're roasting something, meat of some kind. A rackhunk? Yes, there's the tail, over there on the ground. They must have shot it. The poor creature. Snowman hasn't smelled roast meat for so long. Is that why his eyes are watering? He's shivering now. He's feverish again. What next? Advance with a strip of bedsheet tied to a stick, waving a white flag? I come in peace. But he doesn't have his bedsheet with him. Or, I can show you much treasure. But no, he has nothing to trade with them, nor they with him. Nothing except themselves. They could listen to him. They could hear his tale. He could hear theirs. They at least would understand something of what he's been through. Or, get the hell off my turf before I blow you off, as in some old-style Western film. Hands up, back away, leave that spray gun. That wouldn't be the end of it, though. There are three of them, and only one of him. They'd do what he'd do in their place. They'd go away, but they'd lurk. They'd spy. They'd sneak up on him in the dark, conk him on the head with a rock. He'd never know when they might come. He could finish it now, before they see him, while he still has the strength, while he can still stand up. His foot's like a shoeful of liquid fire. But they haven't done anything bad, not to him. Should he kill them in cold blood? Is he able to? And if he starts killing them, and then stops, one of them will kill him first, naturally.
What do you want me to do?
He whispers to the empty air. It's hard to know.
Oh, Jimmy, you are so funny.
Don't let me down. From habit, he lifts his watch. It shows him its blank face. 0 hour, Snowman thinks. Time to go. This is Campbell Scott. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. This program was produced by Robert Kessler, directed by Robert Kessler and Scott Cresswell, Executive producer, Karen DiMattia. Text copyright 2003 by O.W. Toad Limited. Production copyright 2003, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.